Today on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
And when we win the physical trophy, you know, they hand it to us, and then what we do is we put it in a trophy case or we put it in a special place. But that trophy sits in a case for 10 years, and it collects 10 years of dust. But when you use your platform as a coach or as a teacher, as an educator, and you pour into the hopes and dreams of the people that play for you, that are students that are in your classroom, and you help them and reach the dreams that they have, now they become your living trophies.
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today we are joined by Rhode Island assistant coach Kevin Sutton. I first met Kevin Sutton when he was the head coach at Montverde Academy, and I rolled into his gym outside of Orlando and was blown away by the amount of talent, but not just talent, the level of coaching that was going on in that gym. He does an unbelievable job and has done an unbelievable job as a head coach at his various stops at the national high school level, and has parlayed that into a long career as a college assistant, has been at the high major level, and will be a college head coach, we imagine, fairly soon. Really have a great conversation with Kevin about his upbringing, how he was introduced to the game by legendary coach Stu Vetter, and how he was able to build the programs that he was able to build. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Please write us a review, and please follow along with what we are doing at risingcoaches.com. Before we get into today's podcast, I want to take a minute to tell you about the Two Coaches a Month program. This is an initiative that we created for our members to help them make meaningful, genuine relationships with other coaches in the industry. Everyone knows it's a relationship business. Everybody wants to expand their network. Everybody wants to know what they can do to get ahead. Here's a solution. On the 1st and 15th of every month, we pair up two coaches. We give them a topic of discussion, and the expectation is that they spend a minimum of 10 minutes on the phone with each other, getting to know each other and brainstorming on that week's topic. If you do it for a year, you'll meet 24 new coaches. Pretty simple, pretty effective. And just one of the many perks that you'll receive when you sign up for a Rising Coaches membership. The membership is $120 a year, and you can find out more information by visiting risingcoaches.com/membership. Kevin, good morning. How are you today?
Adam, I'm doing fantastic. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Yeah, we appreciate you being with us and excited to jump in. Why don't you start off by telling us where you're from originally? Are you from that D.C. area?
Absolutely. I am originally from a town called Falls Church, Virginia, which is 7 miles outside of Washington, D.C., but I affectionately claim the DMV, which stands for the District, Maryland, Virginia, as my home area.
Okay. So pretty good basketball out there. What high school did you go to?
Absolutely. Longstanding basketball is played year in and year out in the DMV. I actually went to Flint Hill Preparatory School and played for the legendary coach, Hall of Fame coach, Stu Vetter. And I was very, really fortunate. My senior year is when USA Today started the national rankings, and my high school team, we were nationally ranked, graduated, and we had 5 seniors on our team that all went to play Division I college basketball.
So you get the opportunity to play for a legend right off the bat, which we'll get into that later. I'm sure there's tons of lessons you learn from him.
Absolutely.
But you go on to play at James Madison. Do you have a pretty good career there?
Not the career that I would have liked to have had, nonetheless, it was such an enjoyable experience for me. Going to James Madison, first and foremost, was an honor to receive a scholarship there, being the first person in my family to ever go on to college and graduate from college. So I was very honored to be able to go to James Madison University. But my career was not as what I wanted it to be, but nonetheless, it was such a great experience, and I'm still really good friends with all the guys that I went to college with and had a wonderful experience at James Madison.
You weren't getting buckets like you thought you would, though.
No, I wasn't getting buckets like I thought I was going to be able to, but I still played with some very, very good people that have gone on and have some very good careers outside of the game of basketball and also we had a great time there and earned a wonderful degree from James Madison, which helped me. And also, my college coach, John Thurston, actually put me on this path of coaching because as a senior, he made me a student assistant coach. And then the following year, I was a graduate assistant coach, and then I've been coaching ever since.
Okay, so that's what I wanted to ask you. Did you know going into college that you wanted to coach, or is that something that, you know, the opportunity just kind of was presented to you?
You know what, Adam, I had an idea because, again, I had a really, really close relationship and still do to this day with Coach Vetter. And so I was able to see firsthand how a successful basketball program is run. And then after I graduated from high school, and I would come back in the summertime and coach the summer league team. And it was just a tremendous opportunity, and I got bit by the bug. Maybe I got bit because when I came back and coached summer league team, I had guys like, Dennis Scott, Aaron Bain, and Ronnie Thompson, and I thought this was pretty damn easy because those guys were, went on to have unbelievable careers. Dennis was, in the NBA, and Ronnie Thompson had a good career at, Georgetown, and then obviously Aaron Bain was an All-American. So I kind of knew then, and that when I would go back and play at James Madison, my college coach, John Thurston, saw that I had a high basketball IQ and I had a passion for the game, and my teammates had a great deal of respect for me. So he just said, I know you want to be a coach, so I'm going to put you on that path. And it gave me the tremendous opportunity that I have, still in to be in coaching today.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you did 1 year as a student assistant, and then when you graduate, do you stay on staff? Is it almost like a GA spot?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, it was a GA spot before it became, a GA spot. So, yes, I was able to stay there and learn. Actually, the things that I was doing was what you see a director of basketball operation does today. So I was just doing all of those type of things, just learning literally from the ground up what it takes to run a college basketball program.
And what, so you're probably 22, 23, 24, maybe, you've played with a lot of those guys. We get a lot of our members who have to make a similar transition, and that's hard when you're like the same age as the guys you're coaching. Any advice? I know it was a little while ago, but any advice you have manage that?
Yes. The advice that I chose to follow or the advice that I would give is as soon as you make that decision, that you're going to go into your coaching, and oftentimes you're now coaching guys that you just played with, you have to make that separation as quickly as possible. For me, the separation came over the summer. I went cold turkey from, playing pickup basketball, with my teammates that were going to be seniors, or I just got finished playing with, just moving away from that and just staying, totally into my and pouring myself into my new profession, which was coaching. Staying up in the office and watching videotape and asking a ton of questions and just starting to prepare myself for my next move, which was in coaching. So my advice would be to, distance yourself as quickly as you can from being one of the guys to now staying in the office and learning as much as you possibly can from the people that you're going to be working with, and then just continue to carry yourself and, with a great deal of respect. And then the players will see that you're serious about what you're doing, and they'll respect you and treat you in a respectful manner.
That's great advice. Just like anything, you can't be, one foot in, one foot out. You got to be all in.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So a couple years at James Madison, and then do you go back to working full-time for Coach Vetter?
I did. 2 years at James Madison, and then Coach Thurston got fired, and then they brought in Lefty Giselle. So I spent a week driving Lefty all around Harrisburg and connecting him to all the people that he needed to be connected with the hopes that I could stay on. But he brought his staff. So I had already spoken with Coach Vetter about the possibility that if I don't get retained at James Madison, can I, come and join your staff? And he was already prepared for that. That's what he had in his mind. So I went back to Flint Hill at the time and worked for Coach Vetter for the next 10 years, two at Flint Hill and and two at Harker Prep, and then six at St. John's Prospect Hall. And in those 10-year period, we had an outstanding run. My very first 2 years at Flint Hill, I had George Lynch and Aaron Bain, who at the time were both McDonald's All-Americans, and we had a junior on that team by the name of Randolph Childress. So we were pretty good, really good, actually. And then the following year, we had a backcourt of Randolph Childress and Corey Alexander. And then we had three sophomores that were, you know, coming off the bench. Serge Wicker, who went on to Carolina. Jeremy Dean, who went to Wynn and Marion. A kid named Donnie Douglas, who went to East Carolina. So, you know, then from there, which, like I said, we went to Harker Prep in Potomac, Maryland. And from Harker Prep, after 2 years, I went to St. John's Prospect Hall and worked for Stu there for 6 years. And we won a USA Today National Championship in 1998.
So I want to talk a little. Let's get into Stu Vedder at this point. For anybody who doesn't know him, can you just, I know it's hard to do this briefly, but give us a brief rundown of all the achievements that he accomplished.
Before I do that, I mean, what I'd like to say is he is arguably one of the best coaches that at any level that I've had the opportunity to be around, to play for, to work with, and then also now, you know, observe him from afar, you know. But some of his accomplishment, he's the only high school basketball coach to ever take three different high schools and win national championships. He won a national championship at Flint Hill. He won a national championship at St. John's Prospect Hall, and then he won a national championship at Montrose Christian. So he's the only high school coach to ever do that. And he continues to, I mean, he's put over, I can't even give you a number of players that he put into the collegiate level, professional level. He's just one of the best coaches, tacticians, one of the best coaches I've ever been around.
Yeah, Hall of Famer. What?
Yes.
So what were some of the things that made him unique and made him so successful?
Well, his organization, I mean, you know, he ran his program like a college program, you know, but he was a student in the game. He had a very, very close relationship with Coach Dean Smith. And so he was able to go down to, you know, Carolina and watch, you know, Coach Smith and ask questions about how he ran his program. So Coach Vedder came back and, you know, built his program on a lot of the things that Coach Smith did, you know, sprint to the circle, quote of the day, acknowledging the teammate, everybody stands up when a player comes, you know, comes out of the game, you know, and then when you go into the game, you make physical contact with the person you're subbing in for and find out who they're guarding, and then huddling up on the free throw line. And those are just some of the things, and then how we travel. You know, in high school, when we went to away games, we were dressed in a, you know, a coat tie. And, you know, and that's how we did things in a first-class manner. And it just prepared you. We had study halls. We had weightlifting, you know, program before strength and conditioning was, you know, in vogue. So when you got to the collegiate level, you were prepared to do all of those things that they were going to ask you to do before you even got on the court. You already had, you were ingrained with what it took to be a successful student athlete.
And what about in terms of his ability to connect with his guys? Was he, you know, I think a lot of times you find that the Hall of Famers, the best to ever do it, have a unique ability to connect and build relationships. Does that apply to him as well, or was it more program?
No, that, without question. I mean, you know, Coach has, you know, the ability to connect with his players, build relationships. You know, he was fantastic when it came to that because he communicated. You always knew where you stood, you know, with him. He was very direct. He was very honest. And, you know, it was something that as a player you appreciated. You know, you didn't quite understand all the time, you know, but later on you came to appreciate it because you knew that he had your best interests at heart. And if you kept it in perspective, then he would do anything and everything, you know, to help you be successful. And that's the reason why so many of us still to this day, you know, I'm 55 years old, and any time that I have a very important decision to make, I always run it past Coach.
Is he still coaching?
What's his perspective?
What's he doing
now?
No,
he's not. He's retired.
What is he doing now? Is he consulting or just enjoying retirement?
He's consulting and also running his camps.
Okay, gotcha.
Gotcha. So, going back to your path, at what point do you break away from Coach Vedder and taking on other opportunities?
In 1999, I went to a small Christian school called Montrose Christian in Rockville, Maryland. But just to go back 1 year, 1998, Montrose Christian came and offered me the position to become a head coach. And I desperately wanted to take it, but we had a really good team coming back with Jason Capel, Damian Wilkins, Marvin Lewis, you know, Sherrod Teasley. And we ended up winning a national championship. So I gambled and I bet on myself that the following year, the Montrose job would be open again. And it was. And so in 1999, I went to Montrose Christian to start the program there. But I had done my 10,000 hours. Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours with Coach Vedder all those years before, those 10 years before.
So before we jump into that experience as a first-time head coach, let's go back to that decision-making process of gambling mm-hmm. on yourself. Because that's a tough decision, and that's a tough call that people face all the time in this business. You know, yeah. You're with a program that's, you know, successful. You feel like you got a great group coming back. But there's a great opportunity in front of you. You know, how do you navigate even now today? Like, how do you manage those decisions?
Well, I'm a Christian, so I navigate those decisions in prayer. And you know, it's been really helpful for me in making my decisions. And also, I have people I call my inner circle, my circle of influence, and I discuss those decisions, you know, with them as well. And the decision to stay at St. John's Prospect Hall in 1998 was one. We had a very talented team. We had the year before 1997, we lost one game at the buzzer to Mark Karcher, and I knew we had a really good team coming back, and we had a chance to be really successful. Winning a national championship was definitely something on my mind, but it was the people that the players and my relationship with Coach Vedder and our coaching staff that really, you know, helped make my decision to want to stay and be a part of that and postpone becoming a head coach. Because I knew that we were on the cusp of something great, but more importantly than anything else, the student athletes that we had coming back really understood and bought into what we were doing on the court, off the court, and in the community, and I really wanted to be a part of that.
Yeah, you didn't want to miss out. okay, so you get the job at Montrose Christian. It's still available mm-hmm. a year later, and you move into that role. And you mentioned you did your 10,000 hours with Coach Vedder. So I'm imagining you're super prepared going into Montrose. Was that the case, or is it, you know, was there still a little bit of a curve adjusting to that?
No. I was totally prepared. I mean, one there are many things about, you know, coaching with Coach Vedder and coaching in the Washington, D.C. area that prepares you for your opportunity. And one of those things is the competitive summer league that we had. You know, Coach Vedder coached the team during the season, but every spring and summer, I would coach an additional 25 to 30 games. So I had unbelievable experience preparing the team for practice, preparing the game plan, and actually coaching in the game. So I was, you know, well prepared to take over the Montrose Christian, you know, job from a coaching standpoint and also from the standpoint of how to run a program.
When you took that job, was Montrose a powerhouse then, or did it become one later? Yeah.
No, they were a small Christian school located in Rockville, Maryland, that competed in the Potomac Valley Athletic Conference, and they had probably four consecutive losing years prior to my arrival. And for me, wanting to take that job, it was a perfect fit because, one, like I said, I'm a Christian, and then I would have an opportunity to build a basketball program at a Christian school, and that was a marriage of my two things that are most important to me.
Yeah, you know, when I started getting on the road recruiting in my career, you know, I would go visit these powerhouse high school programs and expecting to see these big time setups and, you know, these giant programs. And it really is most of the time the coaches that make it that way. I'm sure if you didn't know anything about basketball, you visit some of these schools and they're just normal high schools. You know, there's nothing special about it. It's the culture and the values that, you know, is instilled through the leadership there.
And that's an absolute fact. I was reading a book, you know, prior to taking the Montrose Christian job, and the book is called Make the Big Time Where You Are by Frosty Westring. And the premise of the whole book is wherever you are, you know, make that the big time. You know, make that the most special place. Make that the place that you have in, that you've envisioned. And so when I went to Montrose Christian, it had a number of drawbacks and limitations to it. But I never really worried or concerned myself with that, because I knew what I wanted my program to be, and I knew that we had the potential to do that, and that the program is not so much about, you know, what the physical things. It's more about the people and the culture and all the things that you try to instill in your, you know, student athletes. So making the big time, you know, at Montrose Christian was exactly what I wanted to do.
And so you're there for a year, I believe, before you have an opportunity to return back to college at Old Dominion. Was college always the goal for you, or was it just more the opportunities that, you know, seemed too good to pass up?
You know, it was twofold. I always told myself that if I move on to the collegiate level, I wanted to work, you know, with a coach that I had a great deal of respect for. And that would also prepare me for my next opportunity. And so, yes, I stayed at Montrose Christian 1 year. We were 32-5. We were number two team, the number two Christian high school in the country. We lost the national championship down at the NACA by 1 point. I had a tremendous team, Jason Connolly, who was a senior that went on to BMI to transfer to Missouri and just retired 2 years ago from playing professionally. Marvin Lewis was a junior who went on to go to Georgia Tech and start 4 years there and was captain of the team and went to the Final Four, and now is the associate athletic director at Georgia Tech. Guys like Robert Monroe, who went to Quinnipiac and scored over 1,000 points. We had an outstanding team, and so to leave them to go to Old Dominion was something that was a very difficult decision, but it was a decision that I made because Coach Capel, Jeff Capel, you know, Jr., was a personal friend of mine. I coached his son, Jason, you know, for 2 years, and Jason lived with me. So I knew the family very well, and I knew Coach Capel as a man of the highest integrity and honor. And I saw in him something that I wanted to become. And so to have an opportunity to join his staff and learn firsthand from him was something that I could not pass up.
Yeah, and Coach Capel is obviously one of the best. And what are some of the things that, you know, separated him and that he was so good at?
He was and continues to be an influence in my life. He was a tremendous coach, but a tremendous person. You know, he ran his program definitely, and I use the quotation, you know, as a family, but he really ran his program that way. Very connected with the players, and they connected with him. I learned a great deal, you know, from him. And in competing in the Colonial Athletic Conference at that time, there were some of the great coaches like John Beilein, who was at Richmond, Jerry Wainwright, who was at UNC Wilmington, Billy Herrien was at East Carolina, was going to build a great program there. Sherman Dillard won the Colonial 1 year that we were there, and he was at James Madison. So some outstanding, you know, coaches that were there in the Colonial at the time that went on to have unbelievable careers. You know, once they left the Colonial.
And now, a quick break to talk about our partners at Dr. Dish. As the off-season approaches, it's the perfect time to upgrade your training equipment. At Rising Coaches, we highly recommend you to check out our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. They are undoubtedly the best and most innovative training machines. Their newest model for schools, the Dr. Dish CT, is a complete game changer. It has a touchscreen that plays training videos, tracks stats by location, and incorporates on-demand workouts and drills from the top programs and trainers in the world. Check them out at drdishbasketball.com or on social media at drdishbball.
Mention Rising Coaches before you purchase and receive an additional $300 off your next order. And now, back to Kevin Sutton.
So, great experience there at Old Dominion in the CAA, and there for 2 years, and then go back to the high school ranks. Bishop McNamara.
Yeah.
So you're there 2 years.
Yeah.
You have a ton of success, and then you make the jump to Montverde Academy. So everything you've done so far has been up in your, you know, DMV area, your neck of the woods, where you're from, and then you make a jump to Florida, to a small town outside of Orlando, kind of in the middle of nowhere. How did that? I mean, did they approach you? How did that opportunity present itself?
So the headmaster at Montverde Academy, his name is Casey Kesslering, is still a headmaster now. He and I had developed a relationship during those 10 years that I was with Coach Vatter, because every year we participated in the St. James Invitational Tournament. And at that time, Casey was the dean of students at at St. James. And his job was to run the tournament. So every year, when gathering information about the teams, he dealt with me. You know, that's one of the responsibilities that Coach Vatter gave me. So Casey and I developed a relationship, because he would have to get information, you know, rosters, team pitchers, and all those different types of, you know, background information. And so we developed a relationship. And then he left St. James, and we still stayed connected. And he went down to Tennessee to a school there and got his master's degree. And then finally, one day, he was sitting in my office at, as a freshman guidance counselor, Bishop McNamara, I get an email. And it's from Casey Kesslering that says, "Hey, you may not remember me, and you know I was at St. James, and last time that we spoke, I told you I was going to become a headmaster. Well, I've become a headmaster at a school called Montverde, and I want to start a basketball program. Do you know of any coaches?" And I responded back, "Me." And then he called me right away, and he said, "No, I'm being totally serious." And I said, "So am I." And then we talked and about you know, what type of program that he wanted to build, and it was definitely something that interests me, because it was in lockstep with the type of program that I wanted to build and was capable of building. And so he flew me down, and when I arrived at Montverde, to be very honest with you, if 10 coaches came down and looked at the job, I would say that 9 out of 10 of them would have turned it down. But what I saw was untapped potential and vision. And so I went down there, and I was very fortunate enough to build the program that I had always envisioned. It was an international private boarding school with dormitories set on 125 acres, 25 miles northwest of Orlando in Central Florida. There were no drawbacks to me for the basketball. And with the administration, you know, behind me, Casey Kesslering and Dr. Stevens, you know, the 8 years that I spent there were arguably, you know, the 8 best years of my coaching experience.
Yeah. You know, I made the comment earlier, when you go visit some high schools, they don't blow you away from the facilities or anything. It's the coaches that make it what it is. Well, to me, the unique thing about Montverde is it's got both. Obviously, the program that you built there, they're still successful today. But what an unbelievable setup they have! I mean, it really is like a small college campus.
Well, now it has become that. You know, Casey has done a tremendous job of using sports as a vehicle to promote the things that he had already had in place. Like I said, it was always set on 125 acres. It always was 25 miles northwest of Orlando. It was in Lake County. It was always a college preparatory school. But he has done a tremendous job of using sports as a marketing vehicle to get that message out there. And then he does a tremendous job of hiring teachers and educators and coaches as well to balance it all. And he's a tremendous leader when it comes to doing that in this industry. But what you see today, or what people see today, is a byproduct of, you know, years, because it wasn't that way. You know, like I said, when I first got down there, the facilities were very limited. You know, it was the one of the few high schools in the state of Florida that did not have an air-conditioned gym. And when college coaches would come in, we still laugh about it today, I would sit them over in a corner beside this big industrial fan and always tell them, before you turn down the street to come to school, stop at the DP and get the biggest drink of water or soda because you're going to need it.
That's funny. So how long before you really got that program rolling? You get there in 04. Is it right away, or did it take time?
Yeah, I got the program rolling from year one. But I walked into a situation where they had not won. And I also walked into a situation that already had things in place that I had dealt with before. One, like I said, it was an international boarding school. So I had already dealt with it. I had already had coached international student athletes before and had relationships in different countries. Two, it had dormitories. Okay, I had always used host families because the schools didn't have dormitories, the other schools that I worked at. But this, now it had dormitories, so now I would come into a home, and when I recruit, I would say your son would stay in the dorm room versus trying to, you know, convince families to let their son come live with other families or live with, you know, with me or et cetera. So those things were already in place. So in year one, I just came in, and my first team, we won 21 games before anybody in the Orlando area could even pronounce my starting five name. and we were off and rolling from day one. I started three kids from Lithuania, Vytis Valulis from Vilnius, Lithuania, and he is a player development coach for a professional team in Russia. I started Anaminissa Boutros, who played professionally. He went to Hofstra and played professionally in Italy. And I started Gidrius Kinesis. He was from CONUS, and he was a 6'9 shooter. He went to college at Charleston, and Charleston Southern, and then he played professionally. And then the one that everyone recognizes is Luke Machado Bamute. Who went to UCLA with the three Final Fours and Pac-10 Rookie of the Year, and you know, has played professionally for over 10 years. And then a kid named Stefan Bakende, who was also from Cameroon. So that was my starting five. So from day one, we hit the ground running, you know, and we never looked back. That's why in year four, we were able to go 30-0 and win a national championship.
So from right away, you start leveraging your relationships all over the globe and bringing in high level talent. Let's talk about coaching international kids just for a second, because a lot of people struggle there. You know, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, who coaches at a program that does use quite a bit of, you know, they do have quite a few international players on their team that contribute. And we were just talking about how everyone thinks they want an international kid, and you go, you know, pick a random game, you go to it regardless of level, and it's almost like you see the one, a lot of times you see the one random international kid sitting at the end of the bench that is probably pretty talented, but, you know, their talent goes to waste because either there's no attempt to, you know, adjust to their game or whatever the reason.
Absolutely.
Is there anything that you found there to be useful to other coaches or just in your experience coaching international kids?
Yeah, for me, and maybe I'm different, but I love the fact that the international students that I was involved with came with no baggage, okay, meaning that they didn't have any bad habits that our players have. So everything that they were going to learn, I was going to pour into them. They were almost like a clean slate. So because they hadn't played, you know, tons of AAU games, they hadn't played a ton of, you know, pickup games and where you can pick up some really, really bad habits. So to me, I looked at it as a plus, and that I knew that that I was a good teacher, and I would be able to teach them how they could be successful and then develop them, you know, because, you know, most of them play other sports before they start picking up basketball. And that's why oftentimes, especially with, you know, the international, you know, players who play what we call American soccer, they call football, they have unbelievable timing, you know, and reaction, hand-eye coordination, especially if they're big and they play goalie, you know, then their defense is way ahead of their offense. Excuse me. And that's a great thing, you know, if it's, you know, for me, I always thought that was a great thing because if I got them playing defense and understanding defense and the value of defense, then yes, I'll definitely be able to get them to, you know, become a better, you know, offensive player with time.
Do you, is there anything in terms of like adjusting? Because the game is different in different countries.
It's very different.
Is there anything you have to do in terms of, you know, patience or teaching or, you know, adjusting to them? Or is it just, you know, staying with them?
I think you have to have a level of patience without question. But you also have to have a level of patience with you know, with freshmen. You know, and so because their game is different, you have to try to adapt yourself. I have tried to adapt myself to understanding, you know, how they learn how to play the game prior to coming to me. And then I try to assimilate them into how we play the game. And it's been very effective because of the fact that I am a student of the game and I've had international coaching experience and I've been to, you know, other countries and to see how the international game is played. And then I also, because of that, I adapted a lot of things in how I coach, you know, and took from the international game. So, you know, it really helped my, you know, players, you know, that were international to assimilate between the combination of the international game and the American game. That's what I'm, you know, long story short, that's what I try to do.
Okay, so you spent 8 years at Montverde. You have unbelievable success. We touched on it, but you win 489 games, lose 102. So you win 83% of your games, which is unreal. That's in your head coaching career at high school. This is, by the way, just a quick side note. This is when I first came across you and we first met. You probably don't remember this, but I was a 23-year-old assistant at the College of Central Florida in Ocala. Didn't know what I was doing, and this is probably like somewhere between 2006, 2008, and was just kind of wandering around looking for games to go to and places to recruit. And I went to your Christmas tournament, which is now like a legendary, you know, high school tournament. I think it's been going for over 25 years now.
Yeah.
And was just blown away. I remember you had the big fan going. There was no AC, but I think Kevin Durant was playing in that tournament. I mean, just like the level of competition in that gym was unreal. And I was just like, I mean, it was almost like I had the wind taken out of me. I was just sitting back on the edge of my seat like, holy cow, what gym did I stumble into? But to see, it was clear, even for me as a kid who was completely clueless, it was clear to see the level of joy that you coached with. The amount of love that you pour into your guys, the relationships. I mean, you coached them now and you were demanding like everybody, but those things jumped off the page, watching you in action.
First and foremost, I remember vividly when you came to the Montverde Academy Invitational Tournament and, the teams that we had in there. Kevin Durant didn't play in there, but Coach Vedder's team was there, Montrose Christian, and that was the very first time that I ever coached against him. And they had four pros on their team, and I think I had three eventual pros. So it was definitely a high-level game, and I don't think you stumbled there. I think God led you there and to give you an opportunity to see what can be. And so your opportunity sitting there and seeing that definitely, you know, wet your whistle, sparked you, and now it's gotten you to do some amazing things in your career. But yeah, I remember vividly when you came there because that was one thing that I always wanted. Was I wanted everyone that ever came into our gymnasium to feel welcome, and that they could feel like they could come over and they could talk, they could ask any questions that they wanted as to how we were able to do the things that we do. And the other thing that I've always wanted with my program is I wanted to be a a coach that would share his knowledge. And because I was very proud of the student athletes that we had in our program and what they were going to do and what they were going to do and the people that they were going to become. Because the number one thing that I've always had as a dream, you know, Adam, was to use basketball as an opportunity to impact as many lives as I can, to create living trophies. And I've been really fortunate and blessed enough to do that.
Yeah. Can you expand a little bit more on the living trophies concept? You talked about that at our event years ago, but.
Yeah. You know what? For years I struggled with what are we doing here? You know, what is our purpose? What's our why? You know, and I always knew that the most important thing that I could do was to use basketball as a carrot to marry the two things that I'm really passionate about. That is, my faith and the sport of basketball. And so I continue to do that. And, you know, when I speak, and I continue to do that, and hopefully in my coaching and the impact that I'm having on the players is continue to do that. And so, you know, I came up with the term living trophies because as coaches, we all want to win a trophy, whether it be a state championship, whether it be a national championship. And when we win the physical trophy, you know, they hand it to us. And then what we do is we put it in a trophy case or we put it in a special place. And then 10 years later, we come back and we get the trophy out and we invite the team and they take a 10-year anniversary picture. And 25 years will be the same thing. But that trophy sits in the case for 10 years and it collects 10 years of dust. But when you use your platform as a coach or as a teacher, as an educator, and you pour into the hopes and dreams of the people that play for you, that are students that are in your classroom, and you help them along the way become and develop the person that they, you know, and reach the dreams that they have, now they become your living trophies because they're living human beings. They, you know, they have a voice. You know, they have a brain, they have, you know, passion, and to me, that's always been the most important thing is to, if I can use the platform that I have as a basketball coach to pour into student athletes and help them become, you know, living trophies, then I'm fulfilling my mission in life.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And like I said, it's very evident watching you in action that is actually your goal and your mission. And you do have a unique ability, by the way, of remembering any interaction you have with somebody, no matter how big or small that person perceives it to be. You're really good at you know, remembering people that you've met briefly, and you're really good at maintaining relationships. Does that just come natural, or is that something that you work at?
It's a combination of both. It does come naturally. And secondly, I do work at it. I mean, because I value relationships. I'm a relationship-based person. And so I do take an awful lot of time and energy pouring into relationships and developing those relationships and, most importantly, maintaining those relationships. You know, my father, you know, taught me a long time ago that you know, everybody's important. And if I could share this story with you really fast, Adam, you know, I think it'll bring it all, you know, into perspective. My father was my my first football coach. And, you know, he would, after every game, he would be the guy who supplied the oranges, you know, and the after game, you know, Gatorades and all those type of things. Because, you know, each parent has an opportunity to do it, but sometimes where we play and where we grew up, some parents weren't able to afford it. So my dad just took the responsibility and said, you know, we're not even going to worry about that. I'll supply the oranges, I'll supply the Gatorade after every game. Okay, so I'm the starting quarterback and I'm the best player. And there's a kid on our team called Richie King, and Richie never plays. And so after one game, I'm walking up to my dad's car. Everybody runs up there. I'm walking up to my dad's car. And I'm the last person in line, and Richie's right in front of me, and Richie hasn't played, and I scored, you know, two touchdowns, and so I'm like, you know, the player of the game. And there's one Gatorade left, and it only came in two flavors at that time, orange and green, lemon lime, excuse me. and there's only one left, and I'm thinking to myself, there's no way Richie's going to take that last Gatorade. You know, it's my dad's car. I'm the best player. Richie doesn't play. So Richie, of course, grabs the Gatorade, and my dad says, you know, good game, Richie, and he walks away, and there's no Gatorades there. And I just go into, like, a little tirade, and he just quickly puts me in my car, puts me in the car, and we drive home. And on the way home, you know, he's lecturing me about, you know, how, you know, you can't do that. You have to always be humble. You have to always be respectful. And he's giving me these life lessons as I'm traveling home. And so when I get home, my mom says, hey, how'd the game go? And I tell her, and I just, you know, come back and take my shower, and I come back out. And, you know, my dad proceeds to tell her how disappointed he is in me because of my behavior towards Richie. And so I say to my mom, I said, you know, Dad, you know, let Richie take the last Gatorade. Richie sucks. You know, I'm the best player. And then he says to her, this is what we're dealing with here. He doesn't understand humility. And so my mom says, you know what? Go to the refrigerator and then get yourself something to drink, and we'll discuss it. And lo and behold, I look up the refrigerator, and the whole refrigerator is lined with the last Gatorade. They had, between my mom and dad, they knew that I was getting out of character, and so they wanted to teach me a lesson. And so the moral of the story is I don't grab any of the Gatorades. I sit down, and I quickly find out that my parents have, together, have decided that they wanted to teach me a lesson about what humility was and the value of every person. So from that, I have realized that every relationship is an opportunity to build a relationship, and every encounter is an opportunity to build a relationship, and I've always valued that, and I've always respected it, and I've always tried to live my life being humble.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Okay, I wanna shift gears back, and we're not gonna go step by step through the rest of your career here, but you eventually, after 8 years, make the jump back to college. Mm-hmm. In 2011, where you're still coaching at the college level today, for a really, really good Rhode Island team. But what are you doing? Are there some things we get asked this a lot. We get a lot of members of ours who are coaching at the high school level that want to make the jump into college basketball. What's some advice you can give, and what were some things you were doing during your tenure at Montverde to help position yourself? And I do realize your position, your situation is a little unique because you're churning out pro after pro after pro, but still you still have to work at it to make that jump. No one's going to just come find you.
Yeah, I mean, we had a great deal of success, and we were, like you said, turning out, you know, highly successful players. But I also have a great number of players who had successful careers at, you know, Division II and Division III, you know, levels as well. So back to the point of relationships, every coach that came into my gym, I treated with a great deal of respect because I wanted to understand, you know, that relationships are so important. And so I wanted my players to play for good coaches. And so treating everyone with respect, you know, enabled me to build up a network of people that oftentimes would offer me jobs or say anytime I want to get into coaching, you know, please give them a call. So I built a good relationships and good reputation with collegiate coaches while I was, you know, in high school. And the other thing is, like I said, I spent 10 years as an assistant coach for Stu Vetter. And Coach Vetter was the type of guy that only deal with head coaches. Well, that left me to deal with the assistant coaches. And I enjoyed it because I quickly realized who was going to be future head coaches. And so when those guys went from being assistant coaches to head coaches, guess who they called? They called me. I had relationships with those guys, you know, because I had spent so much time, because they were assistant coaches, I had spent so much time while they were recruiting my players, because Coach Vetter only dealt with the head coaches. And so I think it's important to treat everybody with respect and value. And so while I was at Montverde, I continue to do that, and I continue to build my network, and I still do that today. So my suggestion to, you know, young coaches is to treat everybody, you know, with respect and value. And then after you meet them, you should follow up with a piece of communication, whether it be a handwritten note whether it be a text message nowadays or a telephone call, and always, you know, remind them where they met you. You know, hey, Coach Gordon, it was great to meet you at Montverde Academy today. If anything I can ever do to help you, please don't hesitate to give me a call.
Yeah,
how meaningful is that?
Right, right. And you're right. At the end of the day, it's about the relationships. And, you know, are you, regardless of where, it doesn't matter what level you're at, are you able to build enough relationships that when an opportunity is available, you know someone to call, or they know who to call? They call you.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, that's great advice. Let's just, last thing, I don't want to keep you too long. I've already had you on the phone for 45 minutes. Let's briefly talk about some of the coaches that you've worked for at the college level, and then maybe some of the things you're doing now or have done over the last 10 years, because I know the next step for you, I assume, is you want to be a college head coach. So what are some things that you've done to position yourself for that next opportunity? Let's start with that, and then we'll go to the coaches you've worked for next.
Well, I hope that I've done a great job wherever I've been. You know, Pastor Joel Osteen says, bloom where you're planted. I've always looked at every job that I have as the most important job. So I wanted to make sure when I was at, you know, George Washington, I did a great job at George Washington. And then George Washington get me the opportunity to go to Georgetown. And I wanted to do a great job at Georgetown for John Thompson III, and that gave me an opportunity to get to the University of Pittsburgh. And while at Pittsburgh, I wanted to do a great job there for Kevin Sullins, and then that gave me an opportunity to be here at the University of Rhode Island, and I want to help Dave Cox build the program that he's always envisioned in his mind. So the number one thing is to do a great job right where you are, and that may sound, you know, like a cliche, but it's the truth. You know, it's the one thing that you can control is the situation that you're presently in. So I want to make sure that I do a great job of where I am. Secondly, I want to continue to network and build relationships, not just reach out to people when you need something from them. You know, more importantly, to reach out to them when you don't need anything from them and maintain those relationships so it comes off as very authentic and very, you know, organic. And third thing that I do is every Friday, I call it Professional Development Friday. I come up with a list of 100 people that I want to reach out and, you know, and connect with, and I put them in four different categories of 25. It might be, you know, coaches, high school, college, AAU. It might be athletic administrators. Okay, it might be NBA, people in the NBA or a league higher than mine, and it might be in the sports information, you know, or marketing on campus. So those 100 people that I try to reach out and, you know, and touch base in one form or another, and I keep a category of how I reach out to them, whether it was a text message, whether it was a phone call, whether it was an email, and then I record their if they responded. And then I try to keep a tally of that with a goal of obviously being 90% or higher. And then the 10% that I don't get in contact with or get a response from, they become the top of the list the following week. So that's something that I do.
So every Friday, are you hitting up all 100 people, or you're getting one person from each category?
No, I'm trying to hit up 100 people.
Wow. How long does that take?
All day.
All day. And it may be, you know, some people may be a call, other people may be a text or an email. It doesn't have to be a long 30-minute conversation.
No, absolutely. People don't have that time to have long conversations.
So when do you compile that list? Do you have Thursday night, you write down 100 people. And so do you have like a big Excel spreadsheet?
No, I'm still old school, Adam. You're getting too advanced for me, bro. I'm still old school. I'm a piece of paper, a yellow pad, and actually not a yellow pad. I have a notebook that's designated, you know, for that. And so just pen and paper.
And what have you found? How long have you been doing that?
5 years.
And what have you found has come of it?
incredible insights, incredible insights. I found that, you know, how people like to be communicated with, and it's really helped me recruiting as well. But you find out, you know, how people like to be communicated with, meaning some people, they like to hear a voice. So they would rather you call them. Some people, they don't want to hear a voice, you know, and so they'll, you know, with text messages, you can be in multiple conversations at the same time. So some people like, you know, for you to reach out to them in a text message. Other people like handwritten notes, you know, they remember old school and the personal touch that comes with a handwritten note or an email. I have also learned, you know, who stays up late at night and who gets up really early in the morning.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Where did you get the idea to do this? Is this something you just kind of came up with? Or?
It was, Adam. It was one of those epiphany moments where I was just, you know, sitting around to thinking about how can I successfully navigate my career, you know, and how can I organically position myself to be on someone's radar that when they have a job that they would want to hire me. Because our resumes are so flat now, and then search firms are such a huge part of the hiring process. It's not enough for Kevin Sutton to recommend, you know, Adam. You know, it's not enough for, you know, Stan Jones from Florida State with his body of work as being an associate head coach at Florida State with Leonard Hamilton for, you know, coming up on 3 decades to get a job. You know, so you have to do the things necessary that's going to separate yourself without coming across as being self-serving. And that's a fine line. So I just thought long and hard one night, and it was probably like 12 midnight, you know, and I just started thinking of people that I wanted to, you know, reach out and touch base with. And I just started putting down names. You know, one category that's always in there is 25 people that I don't know, but I do want to know or want to get to know. Yeah, and that helps you with that helps you with your cold calls.
Right, right. And then how are you maintaining these relationships? I mean, if you're hitting 100 people a week just on Friday,
right?
I mean, do you just do a good job of staying in touch, or
yeah,
do
you know,
they get work back in the list?
You know, everybody gets back on the list. Everyone, you know, gets back on the list at some point. You know, it could be 2 weeks before I, you know, touch base with a person again. Oftentimes, I try to stay relevant in events that go on, you know, through Twitter or, you know, Facebook or, you know, Instagram, through social media. When you read about, you know, George Raveling, I always know that's like Coach Raveling. He's been a tremendous mentor to me, and our relationship is really strong. But early on, I knew the story behind the Martin Luther King speech. So every February, when it was, you know, every year when Martin Luther King's birthday came up, excuse me, in January, and then also the Black History Month, I would make sure that I reached out to, you know, Coach Raveling, and there was a connection. And then, you know, from there, it's just really, I've been really fortunate enough that he has mentored me in so many different ways. And we have a very good relationship, in my opinion.
All right, give me the, because we don't have time to go through all your coaches, give me the best thing that you've learned, the greatest lesson you've learned from Coach Raveling.
Oh, wow.
Too broad?
yeah, that is really too broad. I would say just that you have to always be authentic in your relationships, bet on yourself. And then also stand up for those things that you know which are right. And you have to develop those things through introspection, finding out who you are. And once you have figured out who you are, then you can have an understanding of everything else. What are your negotiables? What are your non-negotiables?
Yeah, that's such powerful, simple advice, but so strong and stuff that I try to figure out on a daily basis. Any techniques there to help you figure out who you are and what's important to you, or is that just work that has to be done in solitude?
Yeah, you know what? It's work that has to be done in solitude, but then also it's work that has to be done publicly. because once you figure out what your, you know, what your non-negotiables and what your negotiables are, then you have to really be consistent in your actions, because it's in our actions that people are really, really taking, paying attention to. So I try to be as consistent as I possibly can to the things that are, you know, most important to me. You know, I am not, you know, running out here trying to convert everyone, you know, from a religious standpoint, but I do try to live out my religion and my faith.
Kevin, you've helped build some of the most successful high school programs in history. You've won just under 500 games in your head coaching career. It's been 9 years since you've run a program. Are you ready? Are you ready to get back to running your own program? I know you're probably going to give me the political answer and say you love it where you're at, but do you have the itch?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I do. I'm really fortunate to have been coaching for as long as I've been coaching, to have the career I've had. But I do desire to become a head coach. It is something that I've had as a goal ever since I got into coaching, is to be, you know, a head basketball coach. So if the opportunity comes, you know, Adam, and it's in the right situation, I would definitely, you know, welcome the opportunity.
Yeah, and I have no doubt that you'll be ready for it and do what you've done your whole career, which is win at a very high level. Kevin, thanks so much for your time. Really enjoyed it.
Adam, I can't thank you enough. I've been a fan of yours, as you know, for a long time, and I really enjoy what you're doing there with Rising Coaches. I believe in it, but if there's anything I could ever do to help, please don't hesitate to give me a call, brother.
We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Please do us a favor and write us a review. It goes a long way with our iTunes ratings, allows us to reach new listeners and grow our community, which is what it's all about. You can follow along and get more information with what we're doing at risingcoaches.com or on Twitter @risingcoaches.